You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You are now entering the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast, a show that uncovers what's fact, what's fake, and what's fun in the crazy world of pseudo-archaeology. Hello and welcome to the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast, episode 180. I am your host, Dr. Andrew Kinkella, and tonight we are taking on the question, is carbon-14 dating fake? Stay tuned. All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. Episode 180. Damn, dude. So today I thought we would talk about a question that I actually have gotten quite a bit over my career. I've gotten it from students. I've gotten it from the general public. And as a statement, I've gotten it from evolution deniers, right? So from the general public, they're just curious. And they'll be like, hey, Kinkella man, you know, how's carbon-14 dating work? Is it actually really very good? Is it a thing? I've heard that it doesn't work that well, right? They are curious. And I don't mind that at all. I don't mind it when students or just somebody off the street, somebody grabs me off the street and says, tell me about carbon-14 right now. I'm cool with that, man. It's fun to learn. On the flip side, you get people, what I found almost always from the evolution denier world, who will say, no, carbon-14 dating is fake, or carbon-14 dating doesn't work. And the answer is, of course it does. Of course carbon-14 dating works. I'm telling you guys, like, I am very honest and sort of fact-based, and I do what works, man. I'm not going to waste money on carbon-14 dating if it sucks. You know, there are other dating methods out there. And I've always been honest with you guys. Like, I'll talk about dating methods if they kind of suck. Like, I'll give you an example of one that's crappy. Obsidian hydration, right? Obsidian hydration has to do with, of course, obsidian artifacts. This is volcanic glass. And it's used to date basically when the obsidian was last broken, meaning when it was last chipped, right, to make the stone tool. That's the idea behind it. And it's called obsidian hydration because the stone itself will suck in a tiny bit of water vapor over time. And you basically measure how much water vapor is inside right on the surface of the stone, the microscope and all this kind of stuff. I will admit freely, obsidian hydration, my friends, not that great. Not the greatest dating method ever. Now, it's not horrible. It's not foolish, but it's just got a lot of problems. You know, so in real archaeology, if all you have is three obsidian hydration dates and that's it for your entire site, that's not that great. And if I actually had that and I was reporting on a site or something, I'd be very honest. I'd be like, hey, all I have is these three dates. They're coming back as this. That generally makes sense to me, but this could be really off. We'll see what happens in the future, right? That's reality. And, you know, do you spend money on obsidian hydration dates? I never have. Why not? Because I have carbon-14 and other dating styles. Now, I have prepped, you know, 70 samples or something or more, probably more, of carbon-14 over the years. I've prepped samples of bone, right? The remains of not human bone, but like animal bone. I've prepped samples that use seeds, like long ago, you know, seeds that are ancient. I've done the actual charcoal itself, right? I've done shell. I've done a lot of shell. Notice that everything I've prepped is organic. That's the first rule of using carbon-14. What you date has to have once been alive, right? Whether it's a plant or an animal, had to have once been alive. You cannot carbon-14 date a rock. So as with all dating methods, they all have their limitations, their pluses and minuses, stuff they're really good at and stuff that they're kind of crappy at, right? And we in archaeology are very honest with that. Now, how do I know carbon-14 dating works? Because I've worked at several sites, just me and myself. I don't even have to trust anyone. Like, other people could tell me this, but I have experienced it firsthand. where I've worked at actual sites, prepped samples, all this kind of stuff, but I've dated it through other means too. And it all comes across the same, right? I'm not only going to use carbon-14, I'm also going to use tree ring dating if I have it, if I have the remains of plants or something that I could tell the rings from. And there's a whole process to that, which can work very well if you have it, where you can date almost to the year. You can use artifactual style, right? You look at the broken pottery sherds and you can tell they're from a certain style that's from 4,000 years ago or whatever it is. You look at all of it, you guys, every archaeology project I've ever worked on, we have used dating methods from several sources. What you have to realize is we as archaeologists use every dating method we can, you know, and we always really try to have a bit of our budget from an archaeology project set aside for the dating. And everyone in archaeology loves dates. You know, I have found that if you ever read old like field reports or anything, you know, they'll talk about the archaeology site they worked on. They'll talk about the excavations, talk about what they found, what it means. There's always a part at the end where they talk about in the future, what should we do? And I swear to God, you guys, 98% of the time they say, and we should do more dating every time. And honestly, to let you in on a little secret, don't tell anyone. I'm sure nobody's listening to this, are they? It's just us talking, right? For me, whenever I run a project myself, as an archaeologist, you're always worried if you're doing the right thing or if it's going to come out right or if it's going to be good. Just anyone would on any project they do. And I always consciously pay for a couple carbon-14 to make sure that I get some dating, be it carbon-14 or other methods, because I know at very least, let's say somebody comes after me and says, Andrew Kinkello, you've run a terrible archaeology project. Okay, whatever. That's their opinion. I can allow me to retort. I can talk about things that I did that are positive. But no matter what, I can go, you know what? You may think that I ran this project terribly. You may think that I dug in like the wrong locations. You may think that I recorded this poorly, but check out my carbon-14 dates. See, literally, you guys, I've always thought that way. I'm like, if I can just get some good dates out of this, no matter how much someone may think I suck, they can't defend against that one. And it has largely come to pass. It's largely been true. Whenever I tell people, hey man, I got a lot of carbon-14 dates here, they're like, ooh, let's check those out. So why deny this? Why deny something that works so good? And again, I'm not going to spend money on this if it sucks. I mean, the prices are between $350 to $700 per sample. I'm not going to drop that kind of cash if I get back crappy stuff. And I've done, again, as I've said, like 70 of these or something like that. I would long ago have stopped this, you know, if I was like, I ain't going to burn another $500 on this crap, right? And it's been quite the opposite over the years. I've been like, damn, this is like wizardry, right? It's really exciting and interesting to prep a sample. And prepping a sample really just means cleaning it off or just sort of making sure that not a ton of people have totally touched it and spit on it and stuff, if that makes sense, you know, that it's been cared for and that you sort of bag it and tag it and record it like really carefully. And then you sort of get them all ready to send to a carbon-14 lab, right? You deal with them online, you fill out the forms and you weigh the sample and all that kind of stuff. And you record exactly what it is, what kind of shell is it or whatever. And then you send it off. And then in, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks, they send you back a Excel spreadsheet that has how old the thing is. I swear to God, you guys, it's magic. Now, as we'll talk about later, there is a range in the date. If it's 1,000 years old, it'll say 1,000 years old plus or minus 30, right? Or this kind of thing. More on that later. But still, for archaeology, a range like that is great. It's like within one human lifetime. Like, that's awesome. So it does not date to the day, right? Which is one I'm not even going to call them problems. It's just one of the issues, I would say, with carbon 14, which is not horrible. It works really well. And there's so much more. But with that said, let's take a break and then come right on back. Hello and welcome back to the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast, episode 180. It's so funny. I'm part of so many podcasts and situations. Sometimes I have to stop for a second. I'm like, wait, did I say CRM Archaeology Podcast? Wait, did I say Kinkella Teaches Archaeology Podcast? No. I said Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast. And we are talking about the idea of, is carbon-14 dating fake or not? Or are there major problems with it, right? And the answer is a flat no. And the longer answer is, I would tell you if there was. The longer answer is also, I've done a lot of this, you guys, in terms of the archaeology world. I have not actually run the samples in the lab, although I've been to the labs and I've talked to the people who work in the labs and I've watched the process. It's like really cool. But I didn't personally, run my own sample. I did prep them and I do have a deep understanding of this. And I have dealt with some of the, again, I'll just call them issues with carbon 14. And I'll tell you what all those are in a minute. But let's backtrack to be like, what is this carbon 14 thing? What's the deal? So carbon 14 comes to us right after World War II. And it's because of the Manhattan Project, right? They're figuring out how to make an atomic bomb. But they figure out so much more. And one of the things they figure out is this carbon 14 thing. Now, what is carbon 14? So normal living creatures are composed of carbon 12. You've probably heard of carbon based life forms and this kind of stuff. But carbon 14 is a special version of it. It's rare, but it's in everything. It's in every living thing, if that makes sense. And it's, while the thing is living, think of it as you have 100% of your carbon 14 while you're alive. And it's you, it's the blades of grass outside, it's the trees outside, it's your dog. Everything living has 100%. Now, as soon as you die, think of it as it starts to leach out, or it starts to just sort of escape, right? And what makes it so great is we can measure the rate at which it escapes, which is basically the rate of decay. And for carbon 14, that rate is in 5,730 years from the day of your death. If I die today, 5,730 years from now, I will have half as much carbon 14 as I did when I was living, right? So we can measure it. It's one of those sliding scales like that. If we wait another 5,730 years, so 11,000, was that 640 or whatever it is? 460? I don't know. But 11,000 plus years. If you wait that long, you will have half again as much carbon 14. So you'll have a quarter and so on, right? You wait another 5,730 years, it's an eighth and so on. So it's that sliding curve down, right? The trick question is, when do you run out of carbon 14? Of course, the answer is never. But after about, 60,000 years, it's just too little. It'll measure, it'll have a little blip, but it's not enough. You can't date it. It's like carbon 14 detected, but it's so little. So right there is one of the issues with it, right? It only dates stuff that's basically recent to about 50 or 60,000 years old, give or take. Depends on how good the sample is. What's this? If the sample's really good, can you coax a 70,000 out of it? I don't know. I honestly, I've never had to deal with stuff that old with carbon 14. If you're dealing with stuff older than that, dinosaurs, this kind of thing, you're going to have to use completely different dating methods. Potassium argon or so forth. That's completely different. Carbon 14 is also crappy for dating stuff that's really new. And by really new, I mean the last, 250 years or something like that. It's so new that it just hasn't had time to kind of register. It doesn't work as well. You're also dealing with very new stuff where you have like the atomic age, exploding nuclear weapons in the atmosphere isn't the best thing for carbon 14 measurements and so forth, right? There are issues with this, of course, but archaeologists have dealt with these issues for many decades. And I will say, I've probably really been in the carbon 14 game, you know, prepping my samples, all that kind of stuff, for the last, I don't know, 15 years, maybe 20. And in my short time, I've really noticed it getting better because they're ever refining it. They're always making it a little better. That is because of so many things. First, because of how they burn the sample. So when you send a sample in, it has to be burned up. They burn it up to nothing and they record the carbon 14 that comes out in the burning process. There were two ways. They used to be, and there still is, two ways of doing carbon 14, which was regular, which was sort of radiocarbon dating, kind of the regular way. And then there's AMS dating, which is a more focused, you get a slightly better date way with AMS, and you can use even a much smaller sample. With original OG radiocarbon dating, your sample had to be about as big as a golf ball of stuff. So if you're dating shell, you're going to have a pile of several shells that you kind of put in a baggie together to prep. AMS, though, you can date like a seed from like a McDonald's hamburger. You know, it's really much smaller and the dating is a little bit tighter. So in terms of a really great carbon 14 date, I think I've seen something as good as maybe plus or minus 20 years. That's really good. I'll get something back. It'll be like 762 years old, plus or minus 20. That's really great, right? Something bad these days, and maybe you get something back and it says it's 1500 years old, plus or minus 90. That would be bad in carbon 14 dating world. Now that date is not bad. It's just there's more width, you know, in its possibilities. Plus or minus 90 just means it could have happened within the span of 180 years. Plus or minus 20 means it happened somewhere in the span of 40 years, right? And these spans are very highly accurate. In the academic science world, they have a 95% accuracy, all of them. So even if I had only one carbon 14 date, and I've actually worked on it, I can think of a site where they had one carbon 14 date that they took in like the late 70s. I wouldn't put all my eggs in that basket. You know, I get it. But if you do five carbon 14 dates, ooh, you have 10 carbon 14 dates and they're all floating around the same spot, then you're looking really good. You see what I mean? We in the scientific world, we're going to be honest with this stuff. I am not going to sell you the age of a site with one carbon 14 date, but I am going to sell it to you with seven. You know what I mean? Especially if they're from like, ooh, I got some here from shell. I got some here from bone, right? You're using slightly different products from the site. That can be really good. Other issues that can be a pain, but you just have to deal with them. So we already know that, okay, it has to be something that's between about 300 years old and like 50 or 60,000 years old, which luckily for us is basically all that modern archaeology deals with, except for super ancient, you know, Homo habilis or something. It has to be organic. The other things, there is a little bit of variance in the amount of carbon 14 in the atmosphere over time, over the centuries, right? We have mapped that variance. It makes instead of the line being completely smooth, it's a little wiggly. And so what that means is there's certain times in prehistory where there's these little speed bumps where your date's going to be a little bit crappier because it goes straight through a wiggle, if that makes sense. I've dealt with this. I want to say there's a wiggle right around 250 BC. I could be wrong. I forget. It might be 250 AD. But I remember having a couple dates being like, what? And what I mean there is you're expecting to get plus or minus 25 or something, and you get plus or minus 65, you know, and you're like, ah, what? And it's stuff like that, right? So that doesn't make the date wrong. It's just a tick more vague, right, than you wanted. So that's it. So I would call that like the calibration curve. There's always a little bit of a wiggle with the calibration curve. There's also, when you're dealing with marine samples, like shell, which I've done a lot, shell has its own problems because the shellfish, when they were alive, I told you before that we all living things suck carbon 14 out of the atmosphere, right? Marine creatures can suck it in a strange, different way because they're under the water and weird stuff like upwelling can happen where there's not as much carbon 14 in it as there are in other places on land, or there can be a little too much. My point is, it adds one extra step of difficulty. So you have to figure this out based on where you're working, and you will know you have to add, it's okay, for every carbon 14 sample I get, I have to add 170 years or I have to subtract 90 years. It's this extra step for dealing with marine samples. We call it a delta R. I know it gets really wiggly, but like for myself, I think the area of Southern California where I've worked on some of this, the delta R was like, I think it was plus 235 or something like that. So you're supposed to add, you know, 235 years to every sample. It's this kind of thing. And so again, it doesn't make carbon 14 wrong. It's just, these are little tips and tricks to make it that much better or that much closer. And of course, at the same time, we're going to be using other dating methods. We're going to double check. We're going to make sure. I know many archaeologists who actually prefer stuff like looking at the pottery style changes over the carbon 14 dates, right? And they aren't denying the carbon 14 dates. They'll take them, but they kind of working better with the potsherd styles. And I'm fine with that. I am an equal opportunity employer. I do everything, you guys. Like I have tried every, you know, even if it was something as wiggly as obsidian hydration, I'd be like, try one out just for laughs, you know, and see if it works. This stuff has been checked and checked and checked. Again, a really great check is you can carbon 14 date an ancient piece of a tree that has tree rings in it, where you can use tree ring dating to know the actual date, and then you carbon 14 date it and you see if it matches. And then they do, right? So this stuff has been checked backwards and forwards. It's just a really great system. So as I've said, I tell you if it wasn't. My last bit on, you know, issues is the idea of contaminated samples always comes up. Oh, but the sample's contaminated. That's what people who hate the date they got use a lot. Oh, the contaminated sample. I was joking with somebody who ran a carbon 14 lab fairly recently, you know, and I was like, hey, man, how many contaminated samples do you see here? And we both had a laugh because the chances of your sample actually being contaminated are really low. I'd tell you if they weren't. The number of contaminated samples, quote unquote, I've ever run is zero, you know, or prepped. In the early days, before I learned more about carbon 14, I thought some of my samples were contaminated. They weren't contaminated. I just didn't like the date I was getting. I was expecting a different date, see? So the problem was not the science, was not the sample. It was a human problem. It was me, right? Having a preconceived notion of what was there and being wrong. So trust your date when we return. Why do people hate carbon 14 so much? Well, hello and welcome back to the Pseudoarchaeology Podcast, episode 180. And we have been discussing, is carbon 14 dating fake? Or are there serious problems with it? Or it's just not good? And the answer, of course, is no, right? And I've outlined the nitty gritty of how it works, any limitations it has, which it does, and where it works really well versus not so well, right? Now, who wants carbon 14 to be wrong, right? I think there's basically two categories of people that I've seen. Category number one, and this is the very small category. Category number one is real archaeologists and scientists who don't like the date they got, right? They don't like the date that somebody else got. This is rare, but I've seen it once or twice in my career where some archaeologist will accuse another archaeologist of their carbon 14 dates not being good for some reason because the dates don't match the narrative they want, the story of the past that they want to say. And luckily, I have seen that science and the scientific mind does win out. So when people bitch and moan about something like this, it usually doesn't last too long. And it's also blown out of proportion. Now, sometimes you can have reasoned arguments about carbon-14 dating. Like, I could say something if I see some dates and they look a little wrong to me. I could say, did you use a correct delta R for your marine sample? You know, as we learned in the previous segment, right? Did you forget to add the 235 years, right? That it's that kind of stuff. Now, those arguments, they're not even arguments so much. They're just points to be taken. There's nothing wrong with that. Right. That's again, that's how science works. And we talk, you know, talk it out. That's fine. I welcome people look at my carbon-14 dates and be like, hey, did you consider this? Right. I'm always refining. I'm always hoping, you know, to get it to be that much better. But my point is, on the grand scale, we all agree. You know, it's just in archaeology where we might be arguing a little about the plus or minus a few hundred years here or there or something. So that's the lesser one, but I do want to point it out just to be honest. The larger one by far is people who are not scientists getting really pissed at the scientific dates because it destroys the false story they're trying to tell. One example of this is the Shroud of Turin, which I've gone over on this podcast, you guys, good God, I think three separate times. I don't mean to bore you with Shroud of Turin, but the media is boring us with Shroud of Turin. They just keep bringing it up, right? And I'm like, dude, can we let this one just stop the madness? But as I've talked about before, and I will not belabor this point, the actual Shroud of Turin, which some argue is the actual burial shroud of Jesus, it is not. It's from about 1250 AD. Not only does the carbon-14 dating date it to about 1250 AD, the style of the Shroud of Turin dates it to about that time. Our knowledge of history dates it to about that time, because about that time, there was a big uptick in religious frauds. So it all works, right? Oh, and if you look closely at the shroud, it's of like a six foot one tall man. Jesus was not that tall. You can tell that it's actually not even of an actual person. It's from a carving. There's a whole bunch of, there's overwhelming information that shows this was not, had nothing to do with the historic person of Jesus. It doesn't, period, right? And to argue it, this is what makes, I think, scientists and researchers and people in the STEM fields just tired. You know, you're tired of arguing. You don't want to argue because it's not even an argument. It's just a dumb ending, bullied story, you know? And all you can say as a scientist is, yeah, you're wrong. Sorry, man, you know, the grass is green, sky is blue, and the Shroud of Turin's only 800 years old. The other place that I see this in more general sense, it kind of relates in with the Shroud of Turin a little, is creationism. Creationism to me seems to have maybe waned a little in the last decade. There used to be so much more of it, you guys. I used to have to deal with creationists way more. Creationism, the idea of a very young earth, the idea that the earth is only 6,000 years old. Like the shroud being the actual shroud of Jesus, and how that's a pointless argument because it's just foolish. Same goes for a 6,000 year old earth. It's just dumb. There's no other way to put it. That's not me being cruel. It's just stop it, right? It's childish. It has nothing to do with reality. Real science doesn't even entertain that for half a second because they have better things to do. And I totally get that. You know, I get why somebody wouldn't want to do a podcast like this, you know, because they're like, dude, I literally want to do real science. I don't want to debunk the idea that the earth is 6,000 years old. It's silly. So, but looking into creation, I went on to creation.com, and there's a bunch of other places. This is very easy to find. There's many articles written by these, you know, religious institutions in parentheses or in quotes, where they're talking about more proof that the earth is only 6,000 years old. And you guys, it is a utter waste of your time. And it's not even funny. It's not even fun, you know, because it's so ignorant. It's what I like to call active ignorance. where if they're trying to refute carbon 14 dating, they'll say something like, well, look, if you carbon 14 date a piece of coal or a diamond, it registers some carbon 14 in there. So your carbon 14 system obviously doesn't work because these diamonds are supposed to be millions of years old, and the coal, you know, is supposed to be millions of years old, and it doesn't. Oh, it goes on and on. But as I said previously, anything organic, and coal was once organic, you know, anything made out of carbon like that will have a trace. That it never goes to zero. There will have a trace. Like, again, it will blip and go carbon 14 noticed, but there's not enough to date it at all because it's way off the scale. It has nothing to do carbon dating, you know, a recently deceased creature. So that argument's like horrible. It just doesn't follow. It's not serious. Another one they use, and I can't remember if I got this from creation.com or the Institute for Creation Research, you know. You got to love that oxymoron, Institute for Creation Research, that the Great Flood, see, when the Great Flood came, it doused a lot of plants and animals, therefore, I want to say taking out carbon from the atmosphere. You see, you guys, these arguments are so stupid. I can't follow them because you have to turn off your sense sensors, right? You can't use any common sense and you can't use any scientific knowledge. You just have to like go, okay. They're saying that, okay, the Great Flood covered all the animals and plants and killed a bunch of them. So they're taken out of the atmosphere, and that the atmosphere before the flood had much, I think they want to say much less carbon 14 in it or whatever. This is all fantasy. This is nothing to do with reality. There is no evidence for this. If there was, I would tell you tomorrow, I would do, you know what? I would do a special breaking this just in Pseudo-Archaeology podcast. And I would tell you, this is something that, whether it be pseudo-archaeologists, whether it be creationists, what they don't get, science works on facts. If the facts change, we change with them. Period. If the Earth actually turned out to be 6,000 years old, I would think that was incredibly fascinating. It doesn't change my life, right? If the Earth is only 6,000 years old, I don't then get fired. A lot of people think this, right? Oh, well, you wrote papers that assumed that the Earth was millions of years old. Now it's proven that it's 6,000 years old. What are you going to do now living under a bridge? That's not how it works, right? I've done things in the scientific world that ended up being wrong. I will say, not often. My track record's pretty good. Thank you very much. But it happens, you know? You'll think a certain thing or record a certain thing a certain way. I recorded once a human burial that actually turned out to be a woman. I recorded it as a man. In my defense, it didn't have a skull. The skull was gone. I was going based on the pelvis. And in my extra defense, the pelvis wasn't in the world's best shape. But I made a judgment call based on what I saw in the field. I was wrong. I didn't get fired for that. I didn't get reprimanded for that. Were there one or two jokes in the archaeology lab about that I had to deal with? Of course, right? But that's all, right? We understand that we want to do our due diligence in science and do our best, which I always have done. And I have to say, the huge percentage of people I've ever worked with, they do it too. People take it seriously. They want to get the right answer. They want to follow the facts. They want to give the general public the real history of what once happened, and they will use whatever works. On the flip side, pseudo-archaeologists and creationists have a story they push, whether it's Atlantis was the source of all civilization or that the Earth is 6,000 years old. They have a set story that they bend the facts, pour in a decent amount of fantasy, and push. They are salesmen at the end of the day. It's very true. They need to sell their story so bad that they will just lie. How do I know this? I've seen lies about archaeologists. How do I know this? I'm an archaeologist. I've seen them write stuff like, archaeologists don't think that carbon 14 works very well either. Yes, we do. That's just a lie. It's not, oh, half true or whatever. It's just a freaking lie. We don't lie in real archaeology. We don't. There's nothing in it. If you want me to get fired, that's if I, what's called salting a site, if I put fake artifacts on there, or if I truly try to mislead anyone in this field, right? I would be totally written off. I would have no career. And that's how it should be. Now, throughout history, there's a handful of famous examples of archaeologists who were totally lying, right? That, of course, in anything we do, there's a handful of people who are just there to for themselves and to lie or whatever. But the percentages, the numbers are crazy low. The number of people I've known in my career, which is quite a few in archaeology, the number of them I've known who are actually turned out to be liars is zero. Now, look, there's some people I freaking hated. Don't get me wrong. Like, there are some people who I wish black, dark, horrible things to. But they didn't lie. Yeah, again, I didn't want to be in a room with them. I found them just awful. But they didn't lie. Whereas when I deal with stuff, be it from creationism, be it from Graham Hancock or that pseudo-archaeology world, they just lie all the time. And it's tiring. And I think underneath it all, that little voice inside, when you hear people like that talk, I think you know it. I think you can feel it. I think you can feel it. I think you're like, you know what? Something stinks with this. And I'm pretty sure carbon 14 works really great. And with that, I'll talk to you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast. Please like and subscribe wherever you like and subscribe. And if you have questions for me, Dr. Andrew Kinkella, feel free to reach out using the links below or go to my YouTube channel, Kinkella Teaches Archaeology. See you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.